Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
It's Tuesday, July 31st, 2018, and this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll take a trip to Switzerland and find out what Fresno State students are doing at one of the top scientific research centers in the world. Plus, journalist Diana Markham joins us to talk about her new memoir, The Tenth Island, Finding Joy, Beauty, and Unexpected Love in the Azores. We begin today's program, though, with a follow-up on a recent story we brought you on homelessness. One common stereotype about many homeless individuals might be that they're alone, dealing with substance abuse or mental illness. But that's not always the case. Sometimes a homeless person has family nearby, but a strained relationship. We recently reported on a Fresno County program that provides emergency housing for parents and children, usually after they've been separated by the courts. This week, we meet one parent who used that emergency housing. She spent some time on the streets alone while her kids lived with family. FM 89's Laura Tsutsui brings us this story about a mom who got off the streets and why housing homeless families can be a complicated matter.
At first, I was like, oh my God, this is such a bad area, but I'm like, I need to get in somewhere. But now, like, we're here, like, it's great. Like, I feel really comfortable. Like, everybody, like, looks out for each other, and it's nothing like where I was before, and just always watching out and watching your back. It's not like that here.
Christina Montalvo shares an apartment in southeast Fresno with her boyfriend, their baby daughter, and her son. They've lived there for nearly a year, a milestone she's proud of because where she was before was homeless.
I was pregnant on the streets, so then I kind of just felt like I had nowhere to go, and I didn't know about any programs or anything.
Montalvo was addicted to methamphetamines at the time. Her three other children were staying with family members, and she visited them as often as possible. But she says she was really caught up in her addiction.
Just an everyday thing, and then I started selling drugs, and it was just like, I just felt like I couldn't stop. Like, even if I wanted to, I just couldn't. And I did want to. I remember just being in the streets, just like sitting there with my boyfriend, like, what's going to make me stop? Like, I don't want to do this no more. I don't.
Montalvo had heard about Fresno County's emergency housing program, and with a baby on the way, she was determined to get in. She had been sanctioned from welfare before becoming homeless, and she had to clear that first. The day she did was the day she went into labor.
I was like, I can't believe it. Like, no, like, this is, I'm looking online for things like to stop contractions, or I'm like, maybe it's just Braxton Hicks. But I knew, because I've had three other kids, so I knew what was going on.
It was in the hospital after having her baby that Montalvo enrolled in a program to get clean and start putting her life back together. Today, the 32-year-old just finished summer school courses at Fresno City College. She's hoping to transfer to Fresno State soon to finish her degree in business management. Montalvo is one of thousands of families in the county getting help from the Fresno Housing Authority. She offsets the cost of her rent with a housing voucher. Preston Prince is the authority's CEO.
We think that for every family that we're able to help, there's probably three or four that are economically or income-wise are qualified, but we just don't have the resources to help them.
Prince says there isn't a one-size-fits-all approach for housing people or even for addressing homelessness. The Housing Authority partners with other service providers to help their residents get social services along with housing. The approach they use is often called housing first. They try to get people into a place as quickly as they can. But Prince says that does not mean housing only.
We're starting to really focus on wellness, which is a little bit harder to define, but that's what we're really looking for. It isn't just necessarily that someone's in a house, which is great, but that they are connected, right? That they have social connections and human connections and employment opportunities and educational opportunities, and that they have wellness within their lives.
Often, families start their search for resources, including housing, at the Poverello House. Sarah Mirhadi is the chief programs officer there. She says the number of families they assist varies day to day, and it's hard to know exactly how many homeless families are out there. At the same time, assisting families can be different from helping individuals.
It can be a little bit more difficult because a family has multiple issues that are sometimes going along. Also, finding space for them. Homeless individuals sometimes have a little bit easier time finding space. Family shelter here in Fresno is pretty limited for the most part.
This year's homeless point in time count for Madera and Fresno counties says that families only make up 12% of the total homeless population, and that there are less than 100 homeless families overall. In comparison, Fresno Unified School District has documented more than 1,700 homeless children, but many of those families live doubled up with another family. The point-in-time count would consider them to be housed, even if the living situation isn't ideal. But sometimes, that approach of staying with another family or family member can be a temporary fix, something homeless assistance groups call diversion. And in the meantime, they continue to work to get their own place.
I would say that a lot of our families is diversion and individuals, a lot of people coming in. I mean, that's to properly assess them, because resources are so limited, we have to make sure that those limited resources, you have to prioritize.
But Mirhadi, like Prince, says that housing homeless families and individuals always takes a multi-layered approach.
Nobody has the answer. Housing first isn't the answer. It's part of many answers. And that's the one thing. And diversion is not the answer. It's part of a process, the whole thing.
For Montalvo, who was homeless just 2 years ago, she's grateful to have made it this far in the process. She's hoping that it won't be long before she can buy her own house. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
This is Valley Edition. Here in North America, Switzerland may be known most for snowy mountaintops, cheese, and yodeling. But the landlocked European country is also home to one of the biggest and most ambitious science endeavors ever undertaken. And though it's nearly 6,000 miles away, the San Joaquin Valley is leaving its mark there. Valley Public Radio's Carrie Klein recently traveled across the world to the European Center for Nuclear Research, or CERN, and met up with some Valley locals.
1949. Europe recovers from World War II.
Enter CERN as a tourist, and one of the first sights you'll see is the so-called synchrocyclotron, a small particle accelerator that once was CERN's flagship experiment.
The purpose of the synchrocyclotron is to produce and study new particles.
Built in the 1950s, this Cold War-era machine is now retired, but it sets CERN on a trajectory to become the world leader in nuclear and particle physics. 300 feet below the synchrocyclotron, CERN later built a particle accelerator that's 100,000 times more powerful, called the Large Hadron Collider. It's a circular tunnel 17 miles around that smashes protons together at near the speed of light and observes the particles that ricochet out. In 2013, the collider earned CERN a Nobel Prize for finally observing the Higgs boson, nicknamed the God particle. Physicists had been searching for the Higgs for decades. At first glance, CERN appears full of contradictions. Sleek, modern architecture rises up out of brutalist concrete office buildings. Towering sculptures of wood and steel commemorate the study of particles that are less than a billionth the size of a grain of sand. And the sprawling campus straddles two countries, Switzerland and France. But CERN's multiple personalities are part of what makes it work. CERN is operated by close to 18,000 staff, students, and visiting scientists from more than 100 countries. And so Jennifer Tyler and Valentina Lee fit right in.
My name's Jennifer Tyler, and I just finished my first year of my master's degree at Fresno State.
I'm Valentina Lee. I just finished my undergrad in Fresno State.
Tyler and Lee are summer students at CERN. They're spending a few months here between semesters, working alongside staff scientists using the Large Hadron Collider to address unanswered questions about the particles that make up the atoms that make up nearly everything we see.
We use the collector to collect the proton to find out more fundamental particle, or how our universe come from and how our universe start with.
Fresno State began collaborating with CERN in 2008. Thanks to a physics professor named Yongsheng Gao, who established Fresno as the first California State University campus there. Though he's since brought other CSU schools on board, Fresno was the only CSU campus to have taken part in the Higgs research that earned the 2013 Nobel. That history called to Valentina Lee, who came to Fresno State from Taiwan.
When I start apply Fresno State, I look at this program and I was like, oh, this program is awesome. So that's actually one of the reasons I applied Fresno State.
This is Lee's second summer at CERN. It's Jennifer Tyler's first, though she hopes to finish her master's degree and ultimately her PhD here. Since 2008, 47 Fresno State students have summered at CERN, as well as 35 from other CSU campuses. Tyler says she's proud to represent Fresno State abroad.
You've got MIT, you've got Stanford and Harvard and all these other really incredible universities. And then there's Fresno State, which is an amazing university, but it's not a top tier, you know, research institution. So we have the opportunity to show our stuff.
But both students agree. This work is about much more than Fresno State. It's about the ambitious and daunting task of bringing thousands of scientists together to work toward one shared and kind of nebulous purpose, study particles to understand the universe.
On paper, this sounds like the worst idea ever. But the fact that this worked, and it still works, and it will continue to work, is just a triumph of science collaboration.
Many physicists worried that after the discovery of the Higgs boson, CERN would lose its purpose. But Tyler and Lee argue, no way. There's still the search for other theoretical particles, like gravitons, and the quest to understand dark energy and dark matter.
It may not be as glamorous or catch, you know, worldwide attention as the Higgs boson does, but it'll continue to fill out our knowledge of the universe and how it works.
So life at CERN still has meaning.
Oh yeah, life at CERN still has meaning, and it will have meaning for a very, very long time.
And who knows? Maybe some small discovery now will end up as important as another CERN invention from decades ago, the World Wide Web. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. 4 years ago, there were record high numbers of unaccompanied minors traveling into the U.S. from Central America. Since 2014, thousands of young children have been detained at the border. But what do they do once they're released to relatives or guardians in the U.S.? Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports on the story of one young local man and his search for a better life.
Working 11-hour shifts on cornfields in Mendota is some of the hardest work to do. Add school and immigration court to the mix, and you might start losing track of the days. Like one teenager who recently moved to the valley. I would wake up at 11 at night to make food and leave at about 12:15. We go into work at 1 a.m. and get off at noon that day. That's an 18-year-old from El Salvador who traveled to the United States as an unaccompanied minor. We'll call him M. He says his long graveyard shifts on the cornfields were exhausting. He would lose track of the days while trying to stay in his routine. So now, M says he's working on the watermelon fields because it fits better with his schedule. Valley Public Radio is letting him stay anonymous because fears of violence. If you're out on the streets, you don't know who can harm you, the police or gangs. You don't feel safe anywhere. You don't feel safe around gangs or the police. M says he crossed the border when he was 17 and is currently seeking asylum. He says he saw and experienced violence in his own life often, whether it be from gangs or his stepdad. Now that he's here, M says at least he can count on law enforcement for protection. When I report something to the police here, it's different. When I was in my country, one time someone wanted to kill us in El Salvador. My mom called the police and they didn't come until the next day. M says it was difficult to build a life in El Salvador, or even go to school. In the small town he lived in, he says most kids would stop going to school by the time they were teenagers. I think I have more opportunities here. Once you turn a certain age, it's not as easy to keep studying, unless you have a lot of money. And M's family didn't have a lot of money. Unfortunately, M is just one of the thousands of other unaccompanied minors who are escaping tough and dangerous situations. And when they finally get to the States, it can get even harder.
there's no attorney appointed for them by the government, so the kids have to find their own attorney. They are living with a relative of some degree, usually, who might have their own kids, might have, you know, their own economic obstacles. They're paying for an attorney can be very burdensome.
Katie Anand is an immigration attorney for Kids in Need of Defense, or KIND. They're one of the only nonprofits in Fresno that provide free attorney services for unaccompanied minors. She says there is zero guarantee unaccompanied kids will get some form of legal status, and many continue to get deported every day.
They have to meet the burden to show they're eligible for some kind of immigration case, which is very hard to do, especially right now. So kids without attorneys are at a very big disadvantage, or kids with attorneys who are not specialized in youth immigration law are also at a disadvantage because there's so much changing right now, and there's lots of nuances to being able to seek protection in the U.S. It's definitely not an easy process for the kids.
And for M, it hasn't been an easy process, but he says it's been better than his life in El Salvador. Back there, I had a lot of stress. I didn't like my life. Also, well, living in El Salvador, it's not having a life. If people see you prospering there, they'll try to take what you have. M says he doesn't know how his life would be if he stayed in El Salvador. But he says it would be a life he wouldn't want to live. Here, he's getting ready to enroll in college courses. And if he is able to get legal residency, M says his goal is to join the army and eventually become a psychologist or lawyer. He says he just wants to help people. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. For years, farmers in the southern San Joaquin Valley have been struggling with reduced water deliveries. The problem, as they see it, has been reduced pumping out of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta, restrictions in place to help that fragile ecosystem recover. But species in the Delta are still declining. Now the state is updating its plan, and it could mean big changes for both farmers and cities that divert water from the San Joaquin and Sacramento rivers before it reaches the Delta. Here to tell us more is Felicia Marcus, chairwoman of the State Water Resources Control Board. Felicia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this plan has not yet been finalized. Staff has presented its findings, and there's all sorts of negotiations going on. We'll talk about sort of what the process is in a little bit, but let's talk about the document that we have right now. Why update the Bay Delta plan now here in 2018?
Well, the water quality control plans are plans that are done to identify all of the beneficial uses of a water body that can be agriculture, fish and wildlife, recreation, municipal, a host of things, hydropower. And they're supposed to be updated and reviewed every few years. They are actually very complex, so it takes a long time to do it. And the current standards are 20 years old, and nearly 10 years ago, the board identified that they were out of date and inadequate to protect the beneficial use, particularly of fish and wildlife, that it hadn't been enough and it wasn't working. And so our staff embarked on what's now a 9-year process of science and peer review and workshops and hearings to figure out how to update that plan to do what we're charged to do under state water law, which is to try and maximize the beneficial uses, not pick one over the others, but figure out how to set that balance in a way that accords with the interests of Californians for healthy recreation, healthy municipalities, healthy agriculture, and healthy fish and wildlife. The discussion tends to be largely about fish and wildlife because that's the one that's been recognized in our law and attended to more recently, and it's the hardest one because folks have diverted water before some of those more modern sensibilities came into place, and they've developed communities and farms and something really magical with that water. So being able to adjust the flows in order to better balance it is a very, very difficult thing to do. I guess that's a long way of saying that's why it takes us so long to do it.
The big headline out of this report goes back to those flows that you just mentioned, unimpeded flow being the big concern. Right now, in some rivers, it's 20% or maybe even less of what would be there naturally, the rest of it being diverted for municipal or agricultural or industrial use. Under this plan, that could increase to 30% or 50% of the natural flow. So how significant is that?
Well, it's interesting. It's certainly not unprecedented. The board in the Mono Lake decision did something similar. We've done similar things on the Carmel River. So it's an interesting proposal in that it's not just a set amount of water, although people have put it that way. It's a block of water we've identified of 30 to 50%, starting with 40%, which on average would increase flows left in the river, sharing the river with fish and wildlife, by about 14% on average. It's not 40% more, it's about 14% more on average. But that said, the notion of unimpaired flow is to come up with a block of water, I think it's February through June, that would leave more water in the stream to share it with fish and wildlife. But the proposal isn't just for that set amount of water. It has a number of offers, in essence, that sort of a more evolved way of setting these sorts of things that say, here's a block of water. If people come together to figure out how to shape the flows, water users coming together with fisheries experts to say, look, we think we can manage it this way and get better results for fish at less water cost, we're open to that. And perhaps the most important thing in it is something that's not novel in a settlement context, but novel in a proposal context, is that at the outset we've said, look, if you come together and add the sort of what are known as non-flow measures that fish also need, they need more habitat to be able to create food production for them when they're little and trying to fatten up to make it out to sea. They can hide from predators if you're going to do predator habitat suppression, if you know, food generation. Habitat can also cool temperatures, and temperatures are very important to them. We'll cut you as much as a 25% discount on how much water and take it down to 30, because we know that fish need all of those things.
Now, along those lines, you have an op-ed in the Sacramento Bee earlier this month talking about this very issue, and you write that it's time for different parties to come together on this issue and meet in the middle, so to speak. Of course, water politics being one of the hottest issues in California just about at any time, but especially now, given the consequences of climate change and drought here in the state. We certainly have seen some groups come together. You have Valley Farmers and urban areas in the Bay Area, the city of San Francisco, and others coming out criticizing this plan. Does that speak to the challenge before you right now, that you have groups that are they're rarely on the same side, in some way at least united on criticizing this?
Well, it's actually not surprising. I mean, you don't expect folks to want to hand water over. It's always that way, and folks are looking at their interests based on genuine, sincere, and heartfelt belief in the importance of what they're doing and the discomfort of what we're proposing. The proposal is seeking to find a sort of a reasonable middle ground with an incentive to do what it takes to come together and manage water actually more intentionally across the spectrum, which is the very thing that we all have to figure out how to do in order to deal with an even tougher set of circumstances we're going to increasingly face under climate change, which means we've got to think about every year and where that water goes and take water and put it away in the wet and even the normal years to save it up for fish and wildlife and people in the drier years. I mean, I think we're going to have to measure more of what we do, and we're moving in that direction. And really, I think the answer is for folks to come together and think about what is the greatest number of benefits, multiple benefits you can get out of each drop of water from the top of the watershed to the bottom, and everybody's got to give. Right now, we're sort of in the middle with folks saying not another drop on the one side, and then, you know, you're not taking enough drops on the other side, and we're looking to find those solutions where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. And that is when people come together and actually restore habitat and work together as unlikely allies to come up with better ways to manage water. It takes people getting out of their warring silos, which are rewarded in the political discourse and legal discourse, unfortunately, more often than it should be. I suppose I'm a recovering lawyer, but my cases when I was a lawyer tended to settle because that's what was actually in my client's interest. In this case, we have the public interest to think of, so it's even clearer.
Now, nothing happens in a vacuum, especially in California water. This is going on at the same time the California water fix proposal is still moving through the system. You have the proposed water projects being funded by the recent state water bond, and you have the state's new groundwater law that essentially is changing the way that we tap the aquifers and moving towards a one-to-one. What you take out, you have to put back in. How does this fit with all these other things that are going on? Isn't that an added layer of potential problems?
Well, I think part of the trick is trying to deal with the reality of the world, which is complicated. I have to say in the first instance that I can't talk about the water fix proposal because I'm a judge in their water rights petition, so I can only hear about it or talk about it in noticed quasi-judicial session, so I apologize for not being able to talk about that one.
Well, we can set that aside, but looking at SGMA, the groundwater law, if you know, Valley growers say we can do this, we can do the recharge and protect the aquifer, we can have these flows, but having both of these hit us at the same time is going to put us out of business.
You know, I think it all requires an approach and an attitude. I think we haven't shied away from saying that we know these are two things that need to be dealt with at the same time, but they're both, again, we're talking about competing goods. On the SGMA side, it's making sure that one's children and grandchildren have an ability to farm because we've not been managing our groundwater basins. We believe very strongly in the approach of having locals do it in the first instance because it's a community resource that needs to be managed there. But we also have been diverting too much away from fish and wildlife. I have to say that the tools that need to be developed in order to deal with SGMA, which arguably is a bigger, an even bigger challenge than what we're proposing, are the same tools you need to manage water intentionally to deal with the fish and wildlife issues. The whole issue is thinking multiple years about water, figuring out how to get water back into the ground when we can. We can take it in the winter months, getting it in faster. The water action plan that the administration came up with 4.5 years ago before the drought even hit was an all of the above, saying that rather than the history of California water, where folks would argue there was just one thing you needed to do, it was all storage or it was all conservation and recycling on the other side, that we have to do all of them and that all the sacred cows had to move aside and that we need to do all of it, more above ground, more below ground. We're in a race to figure out how to manage water more intentionally all across California, and that's a big change for people, but it's something I think that we need to do, and we can do if people put on their can-do hats, so to speak, rather than just the fighting hats. I mean, I've been around this for multiple decades, and I'm more of the social worker in the water wars than anything. I don't think that's just wishful thinking. I've seen those breakthroughs happen. They tend to happen at the last minute, but we've tried to lay out every opportunity, which we'd love to have before we go final, but we've laid out a pathway to be able to accept things later and be flexible. There are some folks who think we're being too flexible, but I think what we really want is for people to come together and figure out how to manage watersheds for the benefit of people and nature, and I think that's doable, but it's not easy.
So are those negotiations still ongoing? Is this going to be something that's going to play out before this is up for a final vote or maybe even after?
Well, we had been hoping we would have things by now, so we're always open to it. I think there's a lot of effort going on. I think folks may come up with the idea of things that we could implement later. I think we're always going to be open to it. It's much easier to do before we go final, but I think that we have an opening directly in the regulation to allow people to be able to significantly reduce the water cost by doing non-flow actions, and we're going to stay open to that through the life of the plan.
Felicia Marcus is the chairwoman of the State Water Resources Control Board, joining us to talk about new revisions to California's Bay Delta Conservation Plan that could mean a lot more water going back into rivers, including the San Joaquin and its tributaries. And that means less water going to cities and valley farmers. Ongoing negotiations still underway about potential habitat restoration and other alternatives. We'll see where that plays out. Felicia, thank you so much.
Thank you for the time.
Here to give us another perspective on the new plan is Cannon Michael, president of Bowles Farming in Los Banos and the chair of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority. Cannon, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate it.
So what was your initial reaction when you first saw this plan that was released in July talking about what are potentially big cuts to Valley Farmers' water deliveries?
Well, you know, of course, Joe, it is a concern. This idea has been around for a little while, but they're trying to push the whole plan forward fairly quickly now. You know, there's been quite a bit of comment given and a lot of input, but seems up to this point to have been mostly ignored, but it's obviously a concern because there's quite a bit of obviously pressures competing on the water system already from the kind of aggressive approach that they've taken. You know, clearly it's going to have a strong, you know, reaction, not just from, I think, ag folks, but ultimately a lot of municipal and even environmental uses that are potentially going to be impacted.
Yeah, you have municipal users as well, many of them often on opposite sides from farmers on the water debate, seemingly together on this one. Is that significant from your perspective?
It absolutely is. I think, you know, it's one of those things that it is rare to find alignment between some of the different users of water. But I think in this case, you know, we've got clear direction from a number of municipal partners as well as, you know, from the refuge folks here locally that we have. And then, you know, just collectively up and down the valley from the east tributary side to the northern folks and then obviously south of the Delta, there's quite a bit of alignment. And I think, you know, the State Board, I think in the larger context, it is interesting that you have a five-member appointed body that is possibly capable of sweeping actions that, you know, obviously water in California is a important issue and a resource that you would want maybe elected officials to have more ability to weigh in on. But here's a group that's you know, taking kind of a more active role in how the system may operate, which I think should be a concern to all the citizens of the state, really.
So for a number of years now, valley farmers who rely on water that is pumped out of the Delta, they faced water restrictions due to the ecological impact of that pumping. But up until this point, farmers on the east side of the valley haven't faced those sorts of water cutbacks, with the exception of the most recent drought. How significant is it that now we're seeing this on the east side, on the San Joaquin and its tributaries, and on farmers who get their water far before it ever gets to the Delta? Is this a significant escalation to bring the goal for natural flows to 30, 40, or even 50% of what they naturally would be?
Those are huge numbers. Ultimately, I think the biggest concern is that we just have to really account for all the uses of water in the state more accurately. And if we're dedicating uses to any user, I think we want to just really make sure that that's going to be the most effective use of that resource. I think what we've seen over the past decades, really since the 90s, is, you know, more of a focus of shifting water supplies to help meet environmental needs, which obviously are an important use in the state for sure. And we want, you know, healthy fish populations. But what we haven't seen is the correlation of dedicating more flow. We haven't seen that necessarily result in a positive impact so far. So just the idea that we're going to just increase that one variable just is what really has a lot of concern, because it doesn't have backing of a lot of the scientific community that would want to see a more comprehensive look at all the components that need to be addressed. Flow obviously is important and water is important. But there's been so much change in the Delta region that really, without doing the hard work, which is the multiple aspects of fixing a complex ecosystem, the flow only is going to cause significant pain to a number of users, and there's not a clear evidence that we're going to see a positive result. And I think that's really the biggest concern.
So you would support then some effort to focus more on habitat restoration? That's, again, something that's up for negotiation, and there are talks ongoing, as I understand it right now. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I think by setting the targets, the arbitrary targets of saying it's going to be 40% or it's between 30 and 50, I haven't been in the settlement rooms where they've had some of these discussions, but I know from talking to a number of folks that it has been a situation where once that kind of a target's being set, it doesn't really give room towards saying, you know, there are a bunch of creative options. It's really just saying you have to just sort of work within this parameter without saying, you know, hey, maybe there's some better alternatives. People are willing to come to the table and put water up for increased use, but that needs to be balanced also with the idea that, you know, you can't just decimate, you know, the communities that rely on that water at the same time. So, again, it just seems like an approach right now that is not looking at it in a balanced and measured way.
This is coming at the same time that farmers and municipalities as well are also facing implementation of the state's new groundwater law that essentially aims to get to a one-to-one state. You're extracting this much groundwater out of the aquifer, you have to put that much water back in. How difficult, from your perspective, is it going to be for farmers to do both of these things if you're having your surface water deliveries cut at the same time you need to focus a lot more on recharging what's underground?
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I think, you know, if you just are looking at it from a mathematical perspective, there's really no way to achieve that. And ultimately, it's going to, even under the best case scenarios, you're looking at, you know, probably 1 million acres of productive farmland potentially on the chopping block in terms of water supply. So it's a huge concern for those of us who live in the valley. And ultimately, again, without feeling like it can result in anything even positive for the environmental side, it doesn't really make anybody feel very good about the fact that this is really the answer. And ultimately, it's you know, something that's probably going to lead to potentially a lot of negative outcomes for folks in the valley, and again, difficulties with seeing a clear path that it's going to fix some of the environmental concerns.
So let's say that this does move forward and the cuts to water deliveries are draconian, at least from the perspective of Valley farmers. How does Valley agriculture evolve if California goes down this path?
I think, you know, ultimately, even without the water constraints, I think what we're seeing with just the overall regulatory environment and the cost increases, I mean, we're seeing smaller farmers really, you know, moving out of being able to handle the rigor of the regulatory climate here in California, which is a big loss. And, you know, ultimately, I think you'll have fewer farms, probably viewing towards the larger farms. But, you know, eventually, obviously, without water, there's only so much that can happen. But, you know, again, the discussion tries to get to just be an ag versus environment, which is something that I've always thought isn't really the right full way to look at it, because, again, we have this really unique refuge complex, you know, the second largest contiguous wetlands in the United States here right in our backyard in Los Banos, you know, critical habitat for migratory birds, for terrestrial species, for, you know, all kinds of unique species, and they need a consistent supply of water as well. Fortunately, I think what's going to happen here is that we're going to just devolve into a lot of lawsuits. There's going to be the continued acrimony between some of the environmental groups and obviously some of the urban and ag groups, and it's ultimately going to be a situation where you know, dollars that could be spent on a positive outcome are going to go to legal outcomes, and usually the legal outcomes result in winners and losers instead of you know, trying to forge you know, a better path forward with you know, some courage and real leadership, and that's where you know, the hard work has to be done. And it's just unfortunate that we, you know, continue to find these polarizations instead of working on comprehensive solutions. But as somebody who works in a complex ecosystem every day here on my farm, you know, it's rarely just the easy one answer that fixes any problem that we have. You know, we look at things in a holistic way in the natural environment, and not just say that there can just be one answer. And I think here we're just looking at this, you know, continued one answer. Let's go down the same path. Let's, you know, since the 90s, keep trying to just throw more water at the problem, and it's not not resulting in the positive outcomes. And so there, again, is where, you know, let's try to back out of some of the courtroom issues, and let's continue the good work that folks in the Northern Valley have done on areas like Butte Creek, showing that, you know, not an increase of water, but habitat projects and floodplain improvements and, get the fish bigger and healthier. I mean, all those things are efforts that are ones that should be applauded and encouraged. And, ultimately, yes, flow is important and there has to be that component. But, it doesn't necessarily have to be done with sort of this hatchet approach. I think environmental problems really need, the scientific community on board, and the water user community can be engaged and will definitely come to the table. It's just now it's being done in the typical way that we'll all retreat and fight, and it's not going to ultimately solve the problems and lead to a lot of frustration and a lot of wasted time.
Cannon Michael is president of Bowles Farming in Los Banos. He is also the chair of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, commenting today on the new plan that's before the State Water Board that would result, if implemented, result in some big cuts to Valley farmers in their water deliveries. Cannon, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Yeah, Joe, absolutely. Anytime. I'm happy to do it.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fresno readers know the name Diana Markham from her byline in the Fresno Bee. Her long-form journalism brought insight into people's lives with the narrative quality rarely found in newsprint. As her career took her to the LA Times, Markham won a Pulitzer for her coverage of California's great drought. Now she's telling her own story and that of the people of the Azores in a new memoir, The Tenth Island, Finding Joy, Beauty, and Unexpected Love in the Azores. Diana joins us on the phone. Diana, welcome.
Hey, Joe. Good to talk to you again.
This book comes out nationwide on August 1st. Let's start out with your first trip. What brought you to the Azores the first time a few years ago?
I was a local reporter, and a photographer dropped a picture on my desk of a man plowing fields with oxen in Central California, in this time, our time periods, which is how the book starts, with this picture being dropped on my desk. And she said, could you find a story? And I said, yeah, how could there not be a story there? So I ended up going out to Tulare and meeting Marai, who was plowing the fields. And he told me that he was from these islands, the old country. And he told me about the Azores, and it just captured me. He invited us to go to a party, and it was after the story ran, but I went ahead and went to the party anyway and took some friends and discovered this subculture in the Central Valley, these places where it's all people whose parents or grandparents or them came from the Azores, and we went to this barn dance, and there were tablecloths on the walls with pictures of the Azores, and there was Azorean music, and everybody was speaking Portuguese, and there was bull poles, and it was just like being in this different place, different time, even though I was still in California. And that's where it all started from.
Now, the San Joaquin Valley has a really rich Portuguese-American community, especially in the dairy industry. You mentioned in Tulare County, that's where a lot of people with ancestry from the Azores settled. How rare was it for you to get a chance to go inside the community, to go to one of those festas? These are great traditions, but largely reserved for members just of that community. Was that a difficult process?
Well, that first party I went to was private, but the festas, all spring and all summer, every weekend, somewhere in the Central Valley, there's a Portuguese festa. And, it's mostly for Portuguese people because that's who know about it, but everybody's welcome. They're very open. Anybody who wanted to go to one of the festas could. And I would suggest that they do. It's really an interesting, piece of this valley.
And how then did you take that in and wind up going to the Azores in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, that's kind of the story in the book, but, it wasn't, the high point of my life in that period. I was kind of lost. I just didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't happy at work. Things were bad in the newspaper industry. I was at that period that I think a lot of us go through at a certain age where I just didn't know what I was doing. I took a buyout from the Fresno Bee and I moved to the Azores with this idea that I was going to go be a big-time writer and write a book. And, of course, I fell on my face and it didn't work. And I had to come back and, you know, it was a much longer, slower process than that. But that's how it got started.
Tell me about the place. For many Americans, many people in the Valley, I imagine, don't necessarily have a good idea of what these islands are like.
So the Azores are the tips of nine volcanoes in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. They're about halfway between Lisbon and New York. They sit, like, I mean, literally right in the center of the Atlantic. They're surrounded by the Gulf Stream, so the climate is warmer than you would expect. You know, it's never really cold. It's never really hot. It's always humid. And they're beautiful. They're volcanic. They're green, black lava rocks. Not white sand beaches, not the kind of place that you would think of as resorts, you know, much more rugged than that. I love them. I find them enchanting. They have villages that haven't really changed too much in 400 years, real traditional houses. Dairy, as you might guess, is one of the main industries, especially on Treseda, which is the island where a lot of the people who live in the Central Valley come from. That's one of the ties, is cows. And, yeah, that's the Azores.
There's this great Portuguese word that is one of those that doesn't have a direct equivalent in English called saudade. What does that mean for you?
Well, actually, I define it as best as I can in the book. Let me see. Of course, I have the book in front of me, right? It's this word that can't be translated. They say there's no equivalent in English or any other language. And how I write about it in the book is it's bigger than homesickness or missing someone. It's a yearning that can be expressed in no other language. It is, as one of Zorian Finn puts it, a strictly Portuguese word. They say it has something to do with death, but mostly life, and maybe the ocean, and probably time. And the only way to understand saudade is to listen to fado, the Portuguese art of the sad song. Or more accurately, songs of longing.
Is that the kind of thing that intrigues you as a writer, to take a feeling that is in some way so unique that it doesn't have one word that can convey the same thing, and a challenge for you to put that into your prose?
Well, I mean, as a writer, I'm fascinated by words, but I think it was more than that. I think it was as a human being, just the concept, you know, maybe we don't have the word, but I think the feeling of longing or thinking there's something just out of your reach is a pretty universal feeling.
You mentioned that when you first went to the Azores, you wanted to write this book. Now you have written a book. How different is it than the book you wanted to write?
Well, it turned out to be the book I wanted to write, but a completely different book than I had in mind. You know, I was thinking of something far more traditionally journalism. You know, there was just this interesting diaspora. I've always been interested in immigration. You know, I like stories of immigration because they're about identity and place and our relationship to place and the idea of home and all of that. Always fascinated me, but I'm a journalist, so I thought I would write about it third person, you know, following this very unique diaspora. But then when I started writing the book, one of my best friends was reading the chapters, and she used to be the column one editor at LA Times, and I started putting funny little personal stories in, and she said, you know, this is your book. This stuff is your book. And my other editors thought so, and everybody started pushing me to be a little more personal. And once I let go of the idea of it being a more strictly traditional journalism book, I just started having fun and wrote it like a letter to a friend and, you know, kind of set aside my pride and let everybody get a peek at my goofy life as well as the Zorian story. And that's the book it turned out to be.
How difficult was that for you as a journalist who's, you know, trained? You go to school and you spend years and years writing about other people and not using the first person and intentionally not putting yourself into the story, at least in most circumstances. That's sort of the conventional way it works in this business. How was it to exercise those muscles that maybe you didn't traditionally use in your day job?
You know, I've been asked this a couple of times now, and it was much easier. Journalism's hard. You know, we work under certain, I don't know if you would call them rules, but in journalism, you know, you triple source things. It's not just your own eyes. You ask somebody and somebody else, and you double check. And, like, I don't know if there's such a thing as objective, but you're trying to get to some sort of objective truth. This was more like writing a letter to a friend. You know, it would be like if I had a conversation with you and I wanted to write about it to a friend, I would tell it from my point of view and not go to you and say, what do you think of this? So that, I think that's the difference. I've noticed a lot of people are reading the book and commenting on it on Amazon and things like that. And some people are saying that they think it's a mix between fiction and nonfiction. And I think that's because I have a note at the beginning of the book explaining that it's not journalism. And I think that people maybe don't understand the difference between journalism and nonfiction, because this is nonfiction, but it's nonfiction the way I would tell you a story or the way I would write you a letter. It's not nonfiction on the level of craft that journalism requires.
At the same time as you're writing this book, the journalism industry is undergoing an intense period of tumult, one that has been building for years now. I don't know how much you can talk about your current role as a journalist, but just with what's been going on recently with the LA Times, new owners leaving Tronc for a new owner in Southern California, returning local control. What has it been like from the outside, looking back in, seeing what's happened to the industry that you love?
Well, it's so interesting because that turned into one of the running threads of the plot of the book. You know, I'm in the first part of the book, I'm pretty disenchanted. You know, journalism's taking all these hits. There's layoffs all over the country. I take a buyout. You know, in the book, I'm giving a speech to the people who are like family to me that it's not just about my job. It's about what's happening to journalism in general. And then I don't want to give away everything in the book, but I think everybody knows I end up becoming an LA Times writer, and I talk about how unlikely that was at that time because the LA Times was in bankruptcy and they couldn't hire anyone. So my editors, you know, went to great lengths to find a way to hire me. I mean, the paper was in that much trouble. So I've lived this, you know, I've lived this whole arc. And then, you know, after the book was done, I didn't know if I was going to have a job to come back to. Things were looking very, very grim at the LA Times. I mean, we were bought just days. It came so close in the neck of time. We were owned by a company that was going to lay off, I forget what it is, like a quarter of the staff or more. And that was after all the hits we'd already taken. We were just really in the final throes. And now there's this fresh start and there's this hope, and we'll see.
You mentioned that you like writing about immigration. So many immigrant groups here in the Valley all share similar stories in some way, maybe one or two waves of immigrants come here. And there's an eventual process of assimilation. That's the American story to some degree. Now, looking back at the Portuguese-American community here in the Valley after being in the Azores, do you have a new insight on it and their ability to maintain their traditions and their identity? Has your view on that and your insights into that changed?
I don't know if it changed. It definitely was what caught my attention. You know, I mean, some cultures find their children very, very Americanized and letting go of their original culture just second or third generation sometimes. And, you know, the Azoreans have been in the Valley for eight generations and they still have these strong cultural traditions, which I find interesting and one of the mysteries that I explore in the book.
Again, we've been talking with Diana Markham today. Her new book called The Tenth Island, Finding Joy, Beauty, and Unexpected Love in the Azores comes out August 1st. Wishing you the best.
Oh, thanks so much, Joe.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. Find our website, subscribe to our podcast, and leave us a comment online at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein, Monica Velez, and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need on the web at chcf.org, and the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.